You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up this hunting season, the DNR is continuing its deer donation program, which helps support food pantries around the state. We'll find out how it works and check up on chronic wasting disease in the state's deer herd. Now, while we may not look a lot like a chimpanzee or a marmoset, our brains have a lot in common. Wisconsin researchers studying the brain cells of human and non-human primates have found similarities and key differences that could help answer questions about developmental and psychiatric disorders. Andre Sosa is an assistant professor in the Department of Neuroscience at UW-Madison, focusing on human brain development and evolution. Andre, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Andre, what kind of things can we learn about human brains from looking at our primate cousins?
Actually, it is essential to look at our cousins, let's say, because to understand what is unique about our brains, we need to compare them to the closest species we have, and only then you are able to distinguish what is different and what those differences mean in terms of function, behavior, cognition, and potential vulnerability to diseases.
And you're looking at a part of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. As I understand it, only primates have that. What does this part of the brain do for us and chimpanzees and everyone else?
Yes, that's correct. It's a structure that only primates have, at least with these characteristics. And it's very interesting because it's involved in certain aspects of cognition that are particularly special in primates in terms of working memory, high cognitive function, also personality traits, exploratory behaviors. So lots of things that we associate with primates and especially with humans. And of course, when some of these functions are disrupted, you can also lead to some psychiatric disorders that are so common nowadays in humans as well.
And you looked at the cells in this part of the brain. How much do we have in common? How much is different between us and non-human primates there?
Well, that's a very good and a very hard question to answer. So we identified 114 cell types in just this particular brain region, and only five of them were not present in the brains of all these species. One was absent in marmosets, one was only present in marmosets, and the other three were present in either humans and chimpanzee. But that's just different cell types. Even when the cells are the same, let's say it's like apples. We are comparing apples to apples, but there are several types of apples, right? Mm-hmm. And so we are able to distinguish between even cells that are similar, what are the differences among those cells? And then we find many more differences than just comparing cell types.
And I mentioned this could help us answer questions about developmental disorders, psychiatric disorders. What are you hoping to learn from these kind of cells that can help with those disorders?
So, for example, we found one cell type that expresses one gene that is been associated to a lot of psychiatric disorders when the function of this gene or the expression of this gene is disrupted. And we found that this gene is expressed in commonly across several cell types between human and the other primates, but only in humans is expressed in this special cell type that is the immune cell type of the brain called microglia. And a lot of these disorders have been implicated with and associated with inflammation processes. So now we have a new idea on how to study these, right? Now it will be very interesting to know what this gene is doing in microglia in humans, for example.
Now, we've got a lot of evolution between us and, say, even our closest relatives like chimpanzees. What in evolution led, do you think, to these the development of these different unique cells in this important part of our human brains?
So there are several processes. Of course, what drives evolution is mutation, right? You have alterations in the gene structure, in several parts of the genes lead to different types of evolution, of course. But the accumulation over these last 6 million years actually have accumulated a lot of differences, not only the brain, but of course in the rest of the body. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, we don't look very much like chimpanzees at first glance, although if you look more carefully, we do look a lot compared to the other species. But yeah, so these mutations will alter the function of the proteins and also will change the places and the amount of expression of these proteins. So when you start accumulating all these small, small, small differences, you generate an impactful difference, right? It's like filling up a bucket full of water, and at the end, it's one drop that makes it go out, right? So it's similar in that sense. You have several accumulation of several small differences that eventually will generate an impactful difference.
What are the next steps now in this research, now that you've found these unique cells that only humans have in this key part of the primate brain?
So we are now studying first developmentally, where do they come from? Where in the brain are they generated? Because usually these cells come from a different part, from progenitor cells, and then they migrate to their final places. So we want to understand what is their developmental origin. And we are very interested, of course, in understanding their function. By manipulating now the expression of these genes, we can start having a good idea on what is the impact of having specific gene expression programs or specific cell types in the brain.
Do you think that this could eventually lead to something therapeutic in the future?
It's hard to tell, but I think it's an important first step to understand what is different between our brain and the brains of other species, to try to grasp exactly that, right? We need to target those differences to start developing therapeutical avenues. Because to be honest, before we know how to treat a disorder, we need to know how the system works normally, right? To then understand what are the disruptions and how can we bring it back to a normal working brain.
Andre, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Andre Sosa, assistant professor in the Department of Neuroscience at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, focusing on human brain development and evolution. He joined us to share some of his team's research on human brains, primate brains, and key differences in a key part of those brains when it comes to brain cells. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about hunting and family.
For many Wisconsin families, hunting is an annual tradition rooted in customs and love. But what happens when those traditions are disrupted, when members of that deer camp are no longer with us? Ron Weber shares his experience with this in A Hunt to Remember.
There was no doubt about it. I was lost. In 35 years of hunting the Shawamigan National Forest near Clam Lake, I had been turned around many times, but never lost. Earlier that morning, I said goodbye to my older brother Rick and Terry, a longtime deer camp compadre. Their departure left me the sole occupant of the small cabin on the crooked shores of Lake Namakagan. Just 3 years earlier, it had been its usual cluttered self as we gathered for those 9 special days in November. As that season unfolded, none of us could have conceived that this would be the last time we would all meet here, and that for this deer camp, it was the beginning of the end. For my brother Jim, next season never came. In April, he was diagnosed with lung cancer, and by November, was too weak to make the pilgrimage to deer camp. Jim's absence hung heavy on everyone's mind and heart. As we closed camp, none of us were thinking about next season. Jim passed away just after Christmas. I wasn't sure if the pain would be healed by the next season. We never got a chance to find out. In September, just as Mother Nature dusted off her palette of crimson and orange to paint the shoreline of the lake, my brother Gary was diagnosed with a tumor on a major blood vessel in his lung. After he left Tuesday morning, there was a pall over the camp the rest of the season. It was understood by all that deer camp would never be the same. Gary passed away in early December. With the heart and soul gone, a couple of the usual campmates did not come for the next season. Now with Rick and Terry gone, I was on my own, and I was truly lost. Like my two brothers, my mentors, my best friends, deer camp was dead. Driving to camp the Friday before the next opening day, I still wasn't sure how the season would unfold. Without the others in camp, I knew I would be hunting with ghosts, but I was not ready for the haunting quiet in the cabin. Like most nights before opening day, sleep did not come easy, but it was not because of the excitement of the moment. It was that discontenting quiet. Opening day was pleasantly uneventful. I saw the usual denizens of the woods, red squirrels, blue and gray jays, ravens, but no deer. Sometime during the day, however, I found my compass. I knew what I had to do. Each day I would choose a different area to hunt. Over the rest of the season, I would be able to make it to the places where we had hunted most and where the trophy memories and good times lay. It had come to me in the solitude of opening day that to go forward, I had to go back. There were goodbyes that needed to be said. What a season it was. I sat in Jim's stand south of Lake Ree, where he had shot several bucks, including a hefty 11-pointer. Then Porcupine Lake, where I pushed a 10-pointer to Gary, his buck of a lifetime. At every spot, I thought, I smiled, I laughed, I cried, I remembered. The last morning of the season, I was up early. Walking in the pre-dawn darkness, I could again sense that feeling of excitement which had been missing. I knew I was no longer lost. Over the course of the morning, I sat, I listened, I watched, I tracked, I hunted. As I walked out of the woods just before noon to close camp, I couldn't help but notice that though there was that familiar sadness the season was ending too soon, I was already looking forward to next November.
Ron Weber is an author and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, find out how the DNR's deer donation program works and how it helps address food insecurity in Wisconsin. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's gun deer season opened over the weekend, and with it comes the return of a DNR program for hunters to make venison donations to food pantries around the state. You could join in at 800-642-1234 as we check out that program. Have you participated as a hunter? Have you made that donation? If you work at a processor that works with this program, love to hear from you. Or if you work at a food bank or use a food bank, has this come your way? Or if you have questions, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Brad Cooley is a wildlife damage specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Brad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Happy to be here.
What are the main features of this deer donation program? What happens?
Yeah, so this is the 23rd year of the program. The program started back in the year 2000. And since that time, hunters have donated over 97,000 deer to the program, which translates to approximately 3.8 million pounds of ground venison being distributed to food pantries across the state to help those in need. So great, great program.
And you've added, as you mentioned, 23 years now, you added a couple years ago a partners program to help find processors to deal with the deer to get it into the food system. How does that work?
Yeah. So unfortunately, we're seeing a decrease in the number of processors, for various reasons. You know, we just don't have as many, licensed meat processors in the state. So 2 years ago, we created a partners program. And the idea of the partners program is any group or organization or individuals, they can rent a freezer truck and serve as a drop-off location. So that started 2 years ago in Marquette County, the Marquette County Land and Water Conservation Department and County Deer Advisory Council teamed up to have our first drop-off location. And like I said, it's just a spot, a business where they have a freezer truck and hunters can bring a deer, donate it, and then they transport it to one of our participating processors. So it's just a way to, with that decreasing number of processors, trying to fill in those gaps and make it convenient for hunters to donate and, get those deer to people in need.
Yeah, talk us through the nuts and bolts. If a hunter is listening and saying, yeah, I'd love to do this, what do they do?
Yeah, it's pretty simple for the hunter. You know, field dress your deer, register it like you normally would, and then take a look on the DNR's website. We have a list, you know, go to the DNR's website, keyword search, deer donation program. We have all our drop-off locations posted on the DNR's website. This year we have 51 processors participating in the program and three additional drop-off locations. So look at one of those drop-off locations convenient and nearest to the hunter. Also look at the map that's on the DNR's website. We do, depending on if the deer was harvested in a county with chronic wasting disease, we do require testing, you know, for some of the deer with chronic, in counties that have chronic wasting disease. So this year, for example, there's 17 counties where adults and fawns are required to be tested for a chronic wasting disease and 19 counties where just adults are. So take a look at that map on the DNR's website. If the deer does need to be tested for chronic wasting disease, go to one of our CWD testing locations or kiosks and have that sample pulled and then take that deer to the processor and have it donated. You know, from there, the processor and the volunteers do the work. That deer is processed. The deer needs to be brought in whole. It's processed into ground venison, into 1 or 2 pound tubes of ground venison, and then volunteers distribute that to food pantries that have signed up and are willing and accepting that venison.
Some hunters might be thinking, this sounds great, but I do want to keep a trophy. Is that an option?
That's an option. Yep, you bet. We'll still make arrangements to allow you to keep the head and that cape of that deer if you need to. But yeah, certainly, you know, we'll take any deer that hunters are willing to donate.
Talking to Brad Cooley from Wisconsin's DNR, looking at the DNR's deer donation program, 23rd year in existence, how it works, how people can participate. You can join in if you have at 800-642-1234 to tell us about it or ask your questions, 800-642-1234. Now, I know we're just getting rolling here. Do you have any indication of how much deer is coming into this program so far this season?
Yeah, on average, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, you know, we'll see anywhere between 1,300 to 1,600 deer donated. I did call a few of our processors today just to see, you know, what type of activity they had over opening weekend. And, you know, most of our processors said that, you know, the number of deer being donated are down or comparable to last year. However, those processors did say that the number of deer they're seeing is up. You know, it's just that many hunters are choosing to have the deer processed and are retaining them themselves this year. So still a lot of deer hunting season left. So we're hopeful that, you know, donation numbers will increase as we go through the season.
Now, I was looking at the maps of processors and food banks that end up using it. This is really, for the most part, a statewide operation, right?
Yeah, statewide. Like I said, we currently have 42 counties that we have either a processor participating or a drop-off location. But yeah, you know, these processors are equipped and set up to take deer that are harvested anywhere in the state. So, you know, certainly anywhere a hunter is harvesting deer or successful, you know, we'll gladly take that deer and get it processed and donated to the food pantries.
Now, you mentioned the CWD, chronic wasting disease, a serious disease affecting deer in parts of the state. I've been following this story since I started producing here, and it was this brand new thing. Are we seeing, you know, the number of counties with required testing increasing in recent years?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, we're seeing an increase in the number of counties where CWD has been detected. There's currently 60 counties where either a wild or captive deer has tested positive for chronic wasting disease or is within 10 miles. 37 counties have had an actual wild positive in them. So, yeah, unfortunately, we're seeing, you know, an increase in the number of positives on the landscape. And we work with the Department of Health every year to set up testing requirements for deer donated to the deer donation program. So, you know, like I mentioned this year, 19 counties require the testing of adult deer and 17 counties require testing of adult and fawns that were harvested in those counties. So we're just trying to make sure that, you know, obviously any deer that is being donated to the food pantries and to those in need is CWD free and you know, safe for consumption.
Now, getting back to the donation program, is this only for gun deer season, or can bow hunters who might be hunting at a different time of the season also participate?
Yeah, great question. The program runs throughout the entire deer hunting season. So we start the program in September with the start of the archery season, and it'll continue actually all the way through January 31st, you know, when those deer hunting seasons end in the metro unit. So at any point during, you know, during those seasons, during that time frame, you know, successful hunters can donate and bring in your deer.
Maybe this is a dumb question, but how about non-intentional taking of deer? The car crash that we all hope to avoid. Can that find its way into the deer donation system?
Yeah, unfortunately not. We only accept hunter harvested deer, you know, and deer that were harvested in Wisconsin. So yeah, any car killed deer, any deer harvested in other states, those other sources, unfortunately cannot be donated through the program.
Makes sense. Now, we talked about how hunters can participate. If there are people listening who are processors or food banks who would like to tap into this, how do they get involved? Probably too late this year, but for 2023.
Yeah, if you're a licensed processor or a charitable organization, we'd love to have you participate. So processors just need to be licensed, through Department of Agriculture. So they have to be a licensed processor. Any charitable organization has to be registered as a 501c3 nonprofit. If you're listening and you meet one of those qualifications, we'd love to hear from you. Again, go to the Deer Donation website on the DNR's website and find my contact information there. The other thing is, not only hunters can obviously help through donation, but anybody else can help as well. There is an opportunity for individuals to make monetary donations to the deer donation program. And of course, those monetary donations, help to pay for some of those processing costs. So if you're in picking up a state park pass or, registering a boat or ATV, there is the option to also make a monetary donation to help, support program costs.
Brad, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Brad Cooley is wildlife damage specialist with the Wisconsin DNR. We talked with him about the state's deer donation program that stocks food pantries around Wisconsin. We've got a link, by the way, to find out more info about the program, plus their partners program for connecting hunters with processors. Find that at our website at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, mental health challenges can feel unique and isolating, but there are a lot of other people in the same situation, and they can provide help for one another. We'll hear more from a mental health expert who wrote the new book, You Are Not Alone. Plus, are Americans getting more angry over time? A Wisconsin anger expert looks back at 2022 in the political world and beyond, and the healthy uses of anger. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, how should the U.S. memorialize its own injustices? A writer takes us on a trip to Germany to learn how that country has tried to remember the Holocaust and to share possible lessons for the U.S. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the midterm elections produced a divided Congress. We'll preview what's in store with Republicans taking over the House, Democrats holding their slim majority in the Senate. First, debates about how we remember American history have gotten louder in recent years. Some communities have taken down monuments of Confederate generals who fought to uphold slavery. Others have tried to keep those statues in place. Some states have restricted the way teachers can talk about race and inequality in the classroom. Others argue that it's crucial to understanding the legacy of racism in America. In his latest book, our next guest toured the country to look at the different ways we commemorate slavery, the Civil War, and segregation. And in next month's cover story for The Atlantic, he traveled to Germany to learn more about how that country wrestles with its own history of the Holocaust and think about what lessons there may be for the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see injustices in American history remembered? Is there a monument, a commemoration somewhere in the country that struck you as particularly good or bad? Do you think the U.S. doesn't do enough to publicly remember things like slavery and segregation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Clint Smith is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He's the author of the book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. It comes out in paperback on December 27th. Clint, thanks for joining us today.
It's so good to be here with you.
So here you had this book. You toured, as I said, a lot of the United States, looking at the different ways we commemorate slavery. Germany was the next step for you. What led you there?
Yeah, so the origin story of my book is that in 2017, I watched several Confederate statues come down in my hometown in New Orleans, statues of P.G.T. Beauregard, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee. And as I was watching these statues come down, I was thinking about what it meant that I grew up in a majority Black city in which there were more homages to enslavers than there were to enslaved people. And thinking about what are the implications of that? What does it mean that to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard? To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Parkway? That my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy? That my parents still live on a street today, named after someone who owned over 150 enslaved people? Because the thing is, we know that symbols and names and iconography aren't just symbols. They're reflective of the stories that people tell. And those stories shape the narratives that communities carry. And those narratives shape public policy. And public policy shapes the material conditions of people's lives, which doesn't mean that if you just take down a statue of Robert E. Lee, you suddenly get rid of the racial wealth gap. But it does help us get a better sense of the sort of ecosystem of ideas that shape American history and that have disproportionately intentionally targeted certain communities throughout American history. And so I was looking around my hometown in New Orleans, and then I started looking around the country, trying to get a sense of how did these different places reckon with or fail to reckon with their relationship to the history of American slavery, travel to plantations, prisons, memorials, monuments, museums. And the more time I spent going around these places, and especially after the book came out, you know, people would often ask, you know, well, what's a good example of a place that does this well? And I would often invoke Germany. I say, oh, you know, Germany has memorials that do this, and Germany has memorials that do that. And I had a moment where I realized I keep invoking Germany, but I've never been to Germany to see their memorials, right? And so I think I had a sort of, it was a revelatory moment for me, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't doing a disservice to the comparison, right? Because to be clear, you know, the Holocaust and chattel slavery are qualitatively different histories, qualitatively different phenomena. I would never suggest, no one could ever suggest they are the same, they are uniquely different. And so what I wanted to do was go there to get a more complex, nuanced, textured, three-dimensional sense of how this place told the story of the Holocaust and what, if anything, the U.S. could learn from it.
And the answers, I think, were complex and nuanced, even among people who agree with the need to commemorate the Holocaust. Any particular example you found, there was some disagreement among them.
And that was a really important thing for me to explore and to excavate. You know, for example, one of the most striking memorials in Germany and really across all of Europe is something called the Stolperstein, which in English translates to stumbling stones. And there are 90,000 brass blocks that are placed across 30 European countries. And there are these sort of 10 by 10 centimeter brass blocks that are placed in front, often in front of the homes and final residences where people who were persecuted and killed by the Nazis were taken from. And so, you know, you'll be walking down the streets of Berlin and you'll stop in front of a office building or apartment building or a synagogue or a home. And you'll look down and you'll see this brass stone that has the name, the birth date, the deportation date, the death date, and the place where the person was killed or executed on this stone. And then you look up at the building and you realize that this is the place that person was taken from. And it's really striking because, you know, you'll be walking down the streets of Germany and you have these cobblestone sidewalks and you walk past one home and you'll see two stumbling stones. You walk a little further down and then you'll see four. You walk a little further down, you'll see six. You walk a little further down, you'll see 12. And you can look down at these stones and you can tell by the birth date and the death date how old the people were. You can tell who the children were, who the parents were, who the grandparents were. You can imagine who may have been cousins who lived there, who may have been neighbors across the hall. And you can imagine, it just creates this really intimate sense of proximity to these people and the humanity of them. With that said, there are people in Germany, there are Jewish people in Germany and across Europe who really value the Stolperstein, and there are Jewish Germans who feel very strongly that against the Stolperstein. You know, for example, the city of Munich in Germany is a place that doesn't allow Stolperstein to get put down because there are many people who think that it's disrespectful to have the names of Jewish people on the ground where they're stepped on or covered in dirt or covered in dog feces. And instead, they make it so that you have to put up plaques at eye level for people to engage in. And so it's just one example of how, you know, people who carry similar histories or who have similar relationships to that history can have very different ideas of what of how that history should be remembered and what the appropriate way to do so is.
But a very striking thing about those Stolpersteine, the stumbling stones, is that and you write about this, they help us connect to people, hopefully as individuals, instead of the vast, you know, 6 million Jewish victims of the Holocaust. We see the person who lived here. Is there a lesson there that we can apply to commemorating slavery where we might think, we're thinking of slaves as a mass instead of as a bunch of individual people.
Absolutely. You know, Gunter Demnig, who is the artist who started the Stolperstein work in 1996, that is the reason that he said he began putting them down. You know, his own history is really fascinating. His father was in the German army. And so in some ways, this him beginning this project is almost a sort of act of contrition in some ways, or it would certainly seem so for the things that he and the fam, you know, and he's not unique in that sense, and because there were so many there are so many German people whose parents were either directly involved or adjacently involved in the crimes of the past, their parents or their grandparents. And so there was a moment where I was with a Jewish historian, and we were standing in front of her former home in Berlin, and we were looking down at these two stumbling stones that were in front of her Berlin apartment. And she, you know, she knew a little bit about my backstory. She knew that I was Black American, that I was the descendant of enslaved people, that I was from New Orleans, which was once the largest, busiest slave market in the country. And we had a moment where, you know, she turned to me and said, "Can you imagine what it would be like if in New Orleans, in your hometown, they had, they put stumbling stone down where enslaved people lived or were held or were sold?" And she was like, the whole street would be packed. The entire, you know, so you'd have entire streets paved in brass stones. And that was such a striking moment for me because it reflected the profound lack of memorialization to the slave trade and to the lives of enslaved people that exist, or that rather that don't exist here in the United States. And I think if we, you know, monuments and memorials, to be clear, are not a panacea, right? Germany is a place that still struggles a great deal with anti-Semitism, with discrimination. It does not in and of itself solve those larger societal and historical issues. But I do think there is something to be said for having such ubiquitous, omnipresent reminders as part of your city's landscape, as part of your country's landscape, that serve as daily reminders of what has been done in your name. And I think if we had something like that here in the United States, it would not, again, it would not get rid of racism. It would not get rid of discrimination. It would not alleviate the disparities that exist across lines of race. But I do think it would be meaningful, and I do think it would play some role in recalibrating and reshaping our collective public consciousness and our collective sense of history, because we would be regularly encountering physical manifestations of reminders of what has happened in these spaces that we walk past every day.
We're talking to Clint Smith, staff writer at The Atlantic and author. He's with us today to talk about his newest piece on how countries can memorialize their own injustices, possible lessons the U.S. can take from Germany and the way it remembers the Holocaust. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think we could do a better job publicly remembering atrocities in American history, things like slavery? Do you see lessons that we could learn from a place like Germany? Do you have questions for our guest about his travels in both countries? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about how we remember past atrocities, historical events, what Germany can teach us through its effort to remember the Holocaust. Clint Smith is with us, author of the book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share, in 2017, our family was in Ireland, and we had an opportunity to stay a couple of nights at a youth hostel where there were two young German men staying, and we had some really interesting in-depth conversations. And, you know, one of the first things they brought up is they didn't understand these statues in the U.S. They said, you know, statues are for commemorating and honoring. And the other interesting facet they brought up is not only did they learn about the Holocaust, but the schools, the children are also taught to learn how to recognize disinformation and misinformation in the media. And, you know, just so when they are presented with information, they can better evaluate it.
Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. And Clint, you write, the conversation about the Holocaust wasn't a given in Germany. There was kind of a generational change that led to some of the things Lisa was talking about after kind of an effort, I think, to not talk about it. Can you tell us about that a little?
Yeah, and this is one of the things that I sort of took for granted until I went to Germany myself. It's this idea that, you know, after the war, there are all of these, you know, millions of people who've been killed, most of them in the military. And so you have a sort of population of people who've lost their husbands and their sons and their brothers, and who are mourning the loss of these people they love, who also lost the war, who are also being told by the rest of the world that they're a sort of pariah, that they were complicit in the existence of a fascist genocidal regime, and that their loved ones who died are also evil. And so there's this strange sort of mix of grief and mourning and shame that ultimately manifests itself for a lot of people in the form of a prolonged silence, right? So Germans just didn't talk about the war. They didn't want to talk about the Holocaust. They didn't want to talk about what happened. Everybody wanted to try to move as far away from it as possible, as quickly as possible. And it's not until the children and grandchildren of those folks who lived through that period of time began asking questions of their parents and grandparents and saying, where were you during the war? What did you do during the war? Did you say anything when you saw Jewish people march down the street? And these, you know, it's a new generation of folks in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, who began attempting to create the landscape of memory that exists in Germany today. And it's notable that most of the monuments didn't go up until the 90s, the early 2000s. The Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe didn't go up until 2005. The first stumbling stone didn't get put down until 1996. And so it was not an immediate reckoning that happened. It took, you know, multiple generations for it to do so, which is not dissimilar to the way that it happened here in the United States. In fact, here in the United States, after the Civil War, it's taken far longer for us to put up in the context of the United States, often take down pieces of iconography that are distortions of our national memory. The Civil War ended 150 years ago, and we are still having conversations about whether or not we should take down statues of a treasonous territory that raised an army predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery, right? So the very notion that we have monuments that exist in these communities and that exist in a sort of historical context in which they were put up with the specific intention of sending a political and social message to Black Americans in many of these cities where they were put up, I think is a reflection of our failure in this country for so long to understand the reality of what the Civil War was fought over, the reality of what slavery was. And so while it did take Germany a long time, it's taken us an even longer time.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. We'll go now to Laura in Cudahy. Laura, hi.
Hi. First of all, it is such an honor to speak to you, Mr. Smith. Your book has been on my short list to read for a long time, and this is inspiring me to go get it. I'm calling because I think it is so important that we have memorials and reminders of the difficult parts of our history. 8 years ago, my husband and I were in Berlin, and we saw the memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe, and it was so thought-provoking. It's huge, you know, you can't miss it. It is huge, and just to wander through that memorial, as I said, was very thought-provoking, and I think we need more of that in this country.
Laura, thanks for the call. Clint, as you wrote in this new piece, you spent time at the Memorial to Murdered Jews of Europe. What did you find there?
It's a fascinating place because, as was said, it's enormous. I mean, it is, I believe, 200,000 square feet. It's 2,800 stone columns that are placed quite literally in the middle of downtown Berlin. It's as if, 2,800 stone columns or 200,000 square foot monument were placed in the middle of downtown Manhattan, or to mark the history of chattel slavery, or if a similar 200,000 foot monument were placed in the middle of Washington, D.C., in front of the White House. I mean, it's so centrally located. You can't miss it when you're in that space. And it's haunting. You walk through and the ground sort of rises and falls like waves, and you become consumed beneath the shadows of these large stone columns. It's haunting. It's overwhelming. And I think it's meant to be so. But as we kind of alluded to before, there are a lot of people who have very different thoughts about whether or not that monument is effective and or not. And, you know, so many, there are many people who think that its scope and scale and size is something that is a reflection of the scope and scale of the Holocaust. You know, obviously nothing can ever be commensurate with that. But the size of it is so important for many people who find that to be one of the most meaningful parts of it. But for others, even the name is too passive, right? Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe. You know, some might say, well, like who killed them, right? Like, why are we using the passive voice in this context? And why are there no, why is the monument itself so abstract? Why are there no inscriptions or names or people? You know, it's in many ways the opposite of the Stolperstein. You know, the Stolperstein are these small, intimate brass stones in the ground, and the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe are these, you know, thousands of huge stone columns with nothing written on them. And so, and because it's a part of the landscape, people engage with it in sort of norm, you know, in ways that people engage with all sorts of different parts of the landscape. There are people who are crying as they walk through. There are people who are taking selfies, puckering their lips. There are children who are playing hide and seek. And so it has become very much a part of this sort of landscape of the city. And as a result, people engage with it in a range of different ways that can often feel unsettling for those who feel most proximate to the history that it is meant to commemorate.
Clint, in our last few minutes, I'm guessing there's no easy answer, but are there things you saw in Germany that you hope could inspire communities here in the United States to change the way we mark and commemorate the slave era in the country?
One of the most important things I realized is that in Germany, it was not the federal government who decided one day, you know, we need to put up markers to the Holocaust. It was not even local governments necessarily that said, okay, we're going to create these monuments or memorials. It was ordinary people in small communities and neighborhoods and schools who said, we need to build pieces of our landscape. We need to create ceremonies. We need to create spaces of mourning and spaces of reflection to account for and atone for and proactively remember this horrific past. And it is individuals in small communities who ultimately are doing the things that create the most meaningful impact at scale. You know, Gunter Demnig, when he started doing the Stolperstein, that wasn't a state-sanctioned project. In fact, the local government there tried to stop him from doing it until they realized how supportive people were of it, and then they backed him. The Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe was something people had to advocate for decades before it actually happened. There's still people today who are working in their neighborhoods to put up monuments and markers to the specificities of the Holocaust in their specific context. And I think the best of that exists here. There's the Witness Stone Project in Connecticut, where there are educators and students who are putting down their own version of stumbling stones in front of the places where enslaved people lived and worshiped. There's obviously Bryan Stevenson's museum in Alabama that is very similar and echoes so much of the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe. Bryan Stevenson will tell you himself that he's deeply inspired by so much of the memorialization that he saw in Germany. There are places in like New York and in New Jersey where there are organizations that are putting up plaques where at the ports where enslaved people were brought in, very similar to some of the train stations that are memorialized in Germany where Jewish people were sent off to these death camps. So it is happening on local levels here in the United States and in Germany. And I think it's just a question of ensuring that more people recognize that they don't have to wait for anyone and they don't have to wait for anybody's permission. They can do this on their own. And I think doing it on a community-based level is often the most effective way to do it.
Clint, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Clint Smith, author of the book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. He's a writer at The Atlantic. With us today to talk about his latest piece there, next month's cover story on how to publicly remember a country's injustices, the lessons we can take in the U.S. from Germany's remembrance of the Holocaust. That piece is called Monuments to the Unthinkable. You can find a link to it at WPR.org/Central Time. That's WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, Democrats will have new leadership in Congress while Republicans face some challenges within their own party. We'll look at what direction the House and Senate could go following the midterm elections. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.